Ecclesiastes is one of them that is difficult, maybe the most difficult book. And that's not an accident. When you observe that Ecclesiastes is difficult, you're not making a mistake. You're not going astray somehow. You are picking up on something genuine. You're noticing something that's actually there. And it's there, it's difficult, and it's difficult for a reason, because it calls upon us to be patient, to wait for the end before we make a decision about what we think on any given passage. In other words, it teaches us to sit with the discomfort of the book, but more than that, with the discomfort of life that the book reflects, and to put all of that in proper perspective. In other words, what I'm saying when I say all of that is that Ecclesiastes is a wisdom book. And you know, you don't just tell somebody wisdom and boom, they're wise. They have to go through the process. They have to internalize the wisdom. So if we can think through Ecclesiastes, if we can accept the discomfort, if we can wrestle with the questions that Solomon, that Kohelet, as he calls himself, the preacher, wrestles with here, then we too can learn some wisdom. But there are no shortcuts. There is no way to just give me the bottom line. Ecclesiastes resists. Give me the bottom line. You've got to work through the process or you're not getting the benefit of the book. So as a book that's inspired by God, as a book that richly deserves its place in the canon, we have much to learn from it, and we'll look at that in a moment or two. On your handouts, I've given you an outline of Ecclesiastes. This is the best outline I've found so far. It comes from the Reformation Heritage Study Bible. And you'll notice that there's three main sections to that. The Roman numerals, or the capital Roman numerals there. The investigation of life, which is the first half of the book. The evaluation of life, which is the second half of the book. And the counsel for life, which is the concluding paragraph. And then underneath that, of course, you can see that it's broken down. There's a poem about life cycles. There's the vanity of striving after knowledge, pleasure, wisdom, the results of labor. And then there's reasons given for. Why does Solomon say vanity of vanities, all is vanity? Well, there's a number of reasons given for that. Everything is temporary. Everything is predetermined. Everything is liable to injustice. Everything is subject to oppression and envy. Everything is prone to loss. Everything is subservient to the fear of God. Everything is a potential frustration. And it's important to notice that when the outline uses everything, or when Ecclesiastes talks about everything, his perspective is very much under the sun. That is a key phrase for Ecclesiastes. So before we say that he's unorthodox or that he said anything that he shouldn't have said, you've always got to remember he's saying this under the sun. And I take that to mean according to his observation, according to what he can find out, and according to what he can find out without the benefit of scriptural revelation. In other words, this is a perspective that temporarily adopts a worldview where God is not intimately involved and where God is not giving information all the time. Now, he's not agreeing with that worldview, and we don't agree with that worldview. But if you take that worldview, what's the best you can do? So that's one of the things that happens in this book. But when it says everything is temporary, well, God is excluded. God is not under the sun. Heaven is excluded. Heaven is not under the sun. So that's why I make that point here. So that's the investigation of life. You've got this poem on cycles, which leads into these sections about vanity and the vanity, the meaninglessness or the pointlessness of life is then explored because of these limitations to which life under the sun is subject. Then you have the evaluation of life, which falls into four sections. You've got the inability to know what to do. And this is something that Ecclesiastes talks about a lot. We don't know what to do. Because the better things are contrary to expectations, because life is unpredictable, because foolishness abounds, because life is full of incongruities. Things don't work out the way you would expect. So that's one part of the evaluation of life. What is life like? Well, we never know what to do. Now, never is a strong word, and I understand we can qualify it, but doesn't that resonate with your feelings at least a little bit? Don't you often run into situations and circumstances where you think, I don't know what to do? That happens a lot. Then there's the inability to know the future. You can't know the future because life is uncertain and brief, because wisdom does not guarantee success. Now, obviously, we'll talk about that in more detail when the sermons reach that section, but isn't that the case? Wisdom does not guarantee success. You can handle things as well as anybody has ever handled them in the history of the world, and it can still blow up in your face. There's a weird sort of comfort to that, isn't there? And then evil happens. Evil is a reality. So in the evaluation of life, we can't know the future. We don't know what to do. There is a right way to use youth. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. There's also something that needs to be borne in mind, and Ecclesiastes sets this out in a remarkable poem in the beginning of chapter 12 about how life is short, how strength is brief, how individuals, but also societies, get worn out and run down, and even the grasshopper becomes a burden. Well, that lines up with Psalm 90, the prayer of Moses, teach us to number our days that we may get a heart of wisdom. You know how Martin Luther translated that? Teach us to think about death so we'll be wise. Because that's what it's driving at. I mean, it's a little paraphrasing the way Martin Luther renders it, but he's getting at the meaning. We are not wise if we don't remember that we're going to die. And Ecclesiastes reminds us of that in a variety of ways. One reason, maybe, Ecclesiastes is not super popular in our society. And then the last section, the Counsel for Life, there's the beginning verse, you notice it says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So that tells you where this is coming from. And then the very last paragraph, verses, some people split it at verse 8, some people split it at verse 9. Verse 8 says, vanity of vanity, says the preacher, all is vanity. So you can take that as being the conclusion of the preacher's words, and then verses 9 and following talk about the preacher. So, in other words, it could be that somebody took this middle section and gave it a little title, and then gave it a little conclusion, because the voice changes a bit. But that last section is, after you've gone through the discussion and you're now ready for it, now here is your big takeaway from the book. Fear God, keep His commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment. That's the answer to vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Under the sun, that is entirely true. But when you factor in the reality of God and His judgment, now we can take a different perspective. Now we can see that things are not just vanity. Why would God judge vanity? What God judges has significance, has import. Now, it might not be a happy significance. It might not be an importance that we're thrilled with. But the reality of eternity and of judgment reinforces to us that vanity of vanities is true under the sun, but vanity of vanities is not true when you widen your perspective. So then we come to the contents and subject of Ecclesiastes. What does Ecclesiastes actually contain? Well, obviously, at the end of a sermon series on it, we'll be in a much better position to answer that than we are right now. But there's a few things that we can go ahead and say. Ecclesiastes contains reflections on the variety of enjoyments, on the variety of activities where conceivably you could find meaning. It contains negative estimates of their sufficiency. It contains a negative judgment over whether they are good enough or not. One of the reasons people have struggled with this book is that it says two kinds of things. On the one hand, it keeps on saying it's all vanity. He'll praise something, he'll say something is better than something else, and then he'll go on to say, but it's all vanity anyway. And people have had a hard time with that. Some people have suggested that it's two different books cobbled together or two different strains of thought or whatever. And I think that's just absurd. There's no textual evidence for it, and it reflects a failure to grasp what's going on. Solomon, everything you know about Solomon leads you to believe that this is self-evidently true. Solomon was not an idiot. Okay? We know that. Solomon was not struggling or intellectually limited. So Solomon knew perfectly well that some things are better than others. Is it better to be healthy than to be sick? Yes. Yes, it is. If those are the only two variables, you're saying, would I rather have a headache or would I rather not have a headache? Well, I would rather not have the headache. Thank you very much. And so would everybody who hasn't lost all touch with common sense. So is life better if I'm healthy versus if I'm unhealthy? Well, if you're only comparing those two variables, yes. Yes, it is. Now, there might be other reasons why an unhealthy person's life is better than a healthy person's life. You know, maybe there's more financial freedom. Maybe there's a more supportive family structure. Maybe there's these other things. You know, there's other variables that enter in. But we can use our brains and we can say, well, health is better than sickness. We can say prosperity is better than poverty. We can say freedom is better than bondage. We can say a lot of things like that. None of those things stop being true. But Solomon is wise enough to be able to add, but ultimately, it doesn't make that much difference. Because whether you're healthy or whether you're sick, you're going to wind up dead. In terms of the final outcome, you can still pronounce vanity over all of it, even though one is more agreeable, more pleasant, better than another. So Solomon has both kinds of things in there, and I think that's a big part of the wisdom we're supposed to learn from this book, is how to appreciate that one thing is better than another, how to be thankful for that, and yet how not to get so invested in that that we lose sight of the ultimate vanity of everything that is merely earthly. There's a number of phrases or words that occur throughout the book. There's the vanity thought. There's the vexation of spirit. There's under the sun. Again and again, you hear the preacher say, "And I saw." In other words, he's observing. He's using his eyes. He's using his brain to study life, to figure out as much as he can. And a large part of what he observes the passage of time. He observes the inevitability of change, but he also observes that change doesn't go anywhere. Things change, but not in an observable direction, not towards everything is getting better or everything is getting worse. There's usually a little bit of both. And he observes the reality of death. The fool and the wise man both die. So you think about those contents. What is the overall theme or subject? Well, one way to put it is to say, what can you learn by observation and without revelation? Well, you can learn that all is vanity. From that standpoint, really, nothing more can be said. So in that sense, Ecclesiastes anticipates the work of the philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer, who decided that everything was meaningless and that the ultimate misfortune was ever to have been born in the first place. And that as long as you're born, the only thing that makes any difference is music. Music lets you forget your troubles for a little while. Apparently, his mom bringing him sandwiches also helped him forget his troubles for a little while. But other than that, he hated everything. He's a lot of fun to read because he does not hold back. He does not pull any of his punches. But of course, you would need to read him when you're not already in a depressed frame of mind, or he's just going to make your problems worse. But Ecclesiastes already anticipated him. You can learn from Ecclesiastes what you can learn from Schopenhauer, and then you can see that Ecclesiastes itself tells you, yeah, that's not good enough. You need something more. God has revealed that He will judge the world. That gives hope. That tells you that life actually does have meaning. And obviously we'll talk about that more, Lord willing, down the road. So I think Ecclesiastes has a lot of value, and I've broken it down here in five main categories, and I think each one would probably be susceptible of expansion. But let's make sure we touch on all the five categories before we expand on any of them, and we'll see how we're doing on time with regard to expanding. So what is the significance of Ecclesiastes? Why is it in the Bible, or what can we learn from it? Well, I think Ecclesiastes has immense value for our engagement with the world in terms of evangelism. And by evangelism, I don't mean just proclaiming the gospel, although certainly I mean that, but I also mean apologetics, understanding where people are, encountering them, talking to them where they are, and hopefully being used by the Lord to bring them along, to bring them closer to the truth. So with regard to evangelism, what value does Ecclesiastes have? Well, Ecclesiastes tells us what unbelievers are experiencing. When you look at what Solomon finds by his investigation of life under the sun, and you realize that Solomon was quite likely the wealthiest man in the region, if not in the world, of his time, that he was the wisest man of the age. In other words, he's the elite of the elites. He has it all. If there is any way to make a good life in this world, Solomon is going to be able to do it. Solomon can't do it. Well, what does that tell you about the ordinary unbelievers who don't have this extreme intelligence, who don't have access to all these resources, who are not sitting on top of the heap? Well, their experience is not going to be better than Solomon's. If anything, their experience will be worse. So Ecclesiastes teaches us to empathize by making us go through it as we hear Solomon's uncomfortable statements that make us squirm. We're reminded on a practical and emotional level of what life is like for unbelievers. And that should help us to understand where they're coming from. That should help us to know how to speak to them. That should help us to adapt our presentation of the gospel to the particulars of the person we're interacting with, as well as giving us just general compassion. This is what life is like. They really need the Lord. Of course, it also reminds us this is what our life would be like without the Lord. And this is what our life increasingly becomes when we're not walking with the Lord, when we're not seeking Him. The reality of life in a world where your heart is alienated from God and the world itself is cursed by sin isn't that much changed by differences in gifts or in advantage. Some things are better than others, yes. Some people have a better life than others, yes. But not ultimately, not on the most basic level, if they're limited to under the sun. Then with regard to our expectations, Ecclesiastes is significant because it reminds us to be realistic. Why do we get frustrated? Why do we lapse into despair? It's because we built up hopes, and hopes were disappointed. Proverbs says that hope deferred makes the heart sick. So how do we avoid that? Well, we avoid that by being realistic in our hopes. And there's two sides to that. One side is not really pinning our hopes on anything other than God's promise, because nothing else is guaranteed. The other side is understanding how many misfortunes and disadvantages can happen. So Ecclesiastes is about that side of it. There's a time for everything. And that means there's a time for chaos. That means there's a time for disaster. That means there's a time for mourning. There's a time for things to fall apart. Ecclesiastes is very clear on that. There's a time to gather stones, and there's a time to scatter stones. Nothing can be added to God's work. Time and chance happen to everyone and everything. And it's easier to ruin than to build. The apothecary might put enormous amounts of effort into making a really special fragrant ointment. But boy, one dead fly can make that ointment stink. He says that in chapter 10. It's easier to ruin than to build. So, how does Ecclesiastes help us with our expectations? Well, in terms of this world, it keeps expectations low. And by doing that, ironically, it pushes us towards, it shuts us up to holding on for eternity. We long for eternal permanence. We long for a good that cannot be corrupted. We long for an end to injustice and to misfortune. Well, then we are going to have to set our hearts somewhere that is not under the sun. Because under the sun, you're going to get all of those things. We have to raise our eyes to heaven, in other words. We have to hang on to the promise of God and understand, as Luther said, that the people of God have all their riches, all their treasure in words and promises, more so than in what we see around us. You'll notice I'm quoting Luther a lot. I think that of the commentaries I've been able to consult on Ecclesiastes, Luther is hands down the best. He has the clearest understanding and the most forceful way of explaining it. Obviously, there are technicalities where his access to different Hebrew texts or different background information, etc., was not as good as it could have been later on. But just in terms of spiritually getting the point, Luther is fantastic on Ecclesiastes. Calvin did not write a commentary on Ecclesiastes, so we can't see how he would have done if he had. Okay, so we need to wrap up here fairly quickly. With regard to our experience, Ecclesiastes shows us what the world looks like when we exclude special revelation about God, judgment, and the future. Now, that's a bleak picture. The picture is vanity. It's all meaningless. None of it helps. That's a bleak picture, and it reminds us of what we're clinging to whenever we walk by sight instead of walking by faith. When I lose my grip on the promises of God, this is the mental world I'm living in. It's all vanity. Well, that should emphasize the importance of clinging to the promises of God, doesn't it? Now, Ecclesiastes affirms the truthfulness of these observations in a limited context. Solomon doesn't deny that this is what people find. When you investigate pleasure and see if you can build a meaningful life for yourself by doing the fun thing all the time, the answer is going to be no. Solomon thinks that's accurate. But he also emphasizes that we need something more solid. He emphasizes that life under the sun is not the whole story. Luther calls Ecclesiastes Solomon's Politics. He also calls the Song of Solomon I forget the exact word that he used, but it was basically, this is about life in the household, domestic politics, and Ecclesiastes is about national politics. And you can understand that because there is a lot of dealing with the king, there's a lot of dealing with the king's spies and the kinds of trouble that people might get themselves into. So calling Ecclesiastes Solomon's Politics makes sense. I think that reduces it a little bit too much, but I think that there is a strong element of truth within that observation. And so Ecclesiastes helps us in our engagement with the world with regard to politics in a number of helpful ways. It reminds us that there are problems on all sides. There is no such thing as a perfect society. Absolute monarchs deal with the reality of sinful human nature in themselves and in others. What can be done by way of political reform is limited. You never fix a society and it's done being fixed. The moment you've corrected one problem, another pops up, or the problem you corrected starts to happen again somewhere else. It is like playing whack-a-mole. There's always another mole popping up somewhere. And Ecclesiastes teaches us that. And that's also, it goes with that idea of keeping your expectations realistic, of living in the actual world. Politics will never be your savior. That's one side of what Ecclesiastes contributes to our view of politics. Politics can't be the savior, and we need to know that. We need to be reminded of that. Sometimes even Christians get forgetful on that point. Now, there's another side to it as well, though. The fact that politics will not be the savior, that political reform is limited, that there's never going to accomplish perfection, doesn't take away the reality that some things are better than others. And it's good to aim at better than, even when perfect is out of reach. So it helps with our political engagement in that we don't invest too much into it. We're not idealists. We're not perfectionists. We're biblical realists. But at the same time, we can acknowledge some things are better than others. That's true in my life. Health is more convenient than sickness. It's true in the life of a city or a town or a state. It's better to have prosperous citizens than for everybody to be poverty-stricken. It's better to have enough to eat than to be experiencing famine. It's better to have things well-managed versus run into the ground. And we can aim for that in our political engagement. We need to be able to distinguish between good, better, and best, but we also need to be able to distinguish between bad, worse, and worst. Mitigating harm is an accomplishment in this world of vanity. It's not the final accomplishment, it's not the only thing we need, but it is a worthwhile goal, and it is a worthwhile political goal. And then, I called it psychology, we could have called it for ourselves, for our individual growth and development. But it also helps, of course, with your understanding of other people. Ecclesiastes teaches us that God has so made us that this world cannot ultimately satisfy. One of the Puritan writers said that if God had made nothing better than the world, the heart of man would have been like Leviathan, like the sea monster in a little pool. So think about it this way. Many of you have had, or maybe do have at the present time, a little kiddie pool, a wading pool that toddlers can get in and splash around in. Is that where you would house your whale? You know, you bought a blue whale or something along those lines. Would you house it in your kiddie pool? You know the answer to that. Taking a human being who has been made in the image of God, who has been made for communion with the Holy Trinity, and saying, be satisfied with the world, that's trying to house a blue whale in a kiddie pool. It doesn't work. Humans are a part of creation, yes, but we're a part of creation that was created to transcend creation, to enjoy personal fellowship with God.